Hello, and welcome to the Green Minds podcast.
Showcasing the science, stories, and solutions behind climate change with Phoebe Scott,
Alex Miller,
Lottie Flashkus,
and Guy Wilkinson.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the IB Green Minds podcast. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Gilad Gershon, who is CEO of Tropic Biosciences. Tropic is an agricultural biotechnology company backed by some of the industry's leading investors, and earlier this year undertook the UK agritech sector's largest ever equity funding. Gilad, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So it's an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. And I thought we could start by just asking you to tell the listeners a bit about yourself and your background and how you came to be CEO of Tropic Biosciences.
Yeah, with pleasure. With pleasure. So Gilad Gershon. I grew up in Israel. I'm a former officer and ship commander in the Israeli Navy. After leaving the Navy, I studied industrial engineering. And for the few years afterwards, I was very fortunate to work as a professional private equity and venture capital investor in the food and agricultural technology space. So kind of sitting on the sidelines and looking at some of the best companies in the world, trying to revolutionize agriculture and food production. I was incredibly inspired by that. Towards the end of, or after a few years of being a venture capitalist, I became also very interested in gene editing technology. I've researched the topic for my employer at the time, Pontifex Agtech. Extensively, we ended up investing in one of the really best gene editing companies out there called Caribou Biosciences. But for me, coming out of that investment, I said, you know, it's such a phenomenal technology. You know, I would love to give it a go and take it and use it in ways that others might have not thought about earlier. So with that, I made a decision together with my wife, and we left the US, where we were based at the time, and we moved to the UK. And together with my co-founders, we founded Tropic Biosciences here in Norwich. So that was a little over 4 years ago. And you know, happy to be here today.
Great. And I guess the natural question is, why Norfolk? And what is it that sort of attracts your company to that location?
So a lot of luck, I have to say. I think that, you know, if you asked me 4.5 or 5 years ago where or what is Norwich, I would probably think about, you know, not the best football in the world. But when we were thinking about where to establish the company, we were very fortunate to work with some of our advisors. And one gentleman in particular, his name is Vincent Pettiard. He's a guy who's quite elderly. He used to be very pivotal with Nestle in leading their applied biotechnology for many years in France. And he said, you know, come and check out the John Innes Center in Norwich. So I did a little bit of Googling, and I found out that there's in Norwich, there's a few very good world-class plant genetics institutions. One of them is the John Innes. Others include the Sainsbury Laboratory and the Erlam Institute. And I flew from Los Angeles to London, took the train to Norwich, met with the people there, and I was just incredibly excited because it was clear that the level of science, the level of professionals there was world class. But with that, there was also kind of a bit of a disconnect from the industry and where I used to go a lot in Israel or in the US with you know, San Francisco, Boston, UC Davis. It felt as if there's still a lot of naivety or a lot of opportunity. You know, there were 50 companies, there was very few business, and you know, they were truly excited about the opportunity to have a new business started in the region. So we came to an agreement with the John Innes Center at the time, and rented a small laboratory within the institution, and we've been growing there since then. I would say that today I realize how incredibly fortunate we were for making the decision, because not only today we are more than 80 people in the company. I can say that many of them are people that kind of received their education and experience locally in some of these institutions. So there's a major draw there, and these are some of the best in the world. Also, I think that still, if you compare the, let's call it the cost per walk in Norwich compared to even Israel, but more traditionally to some places like North Carolina, Boston, San Francisco, it's significantly more economic. So it allowed us not only to get some really, really good people, but it allowed us to do it much more economically and giving us thus the opportunity to move incredibly fast. So even though this industry in many ways started 4 or 5 years ago, I think we gained at least 2-3 years just by being able to, you know, to hit the ground running in Norwich, which I'm not sure what we would have been able to do that elsewhere.
That's a really helpful sort of introduction. And I guess you've talked a little bit about your competitive advantage and how you could be helped by the access to the John Innes Institute. Gene editing is obviously a very complex topic, and I think it would probably be interesting for the listeners if you could provide at a high level a brief explanation of what this is and what it is which gives Tropic Biosciences and its technology platform a competitive advantage versus other technologies out there.
Sure. So we can look at this question from many different aspects. I would say that we can compare gene editing to other technologies that are designed to achieve the same goal. Or even within the gene editing space, why is Tropic Biosciences different? Now, as for an explanation of that technology, I love doing it, but I will say that I'm not a researcher, I'm not a biologist, which is a good thing, because if some of my colleagues are incredibly deep and smart, and they could have done a better job, but it would also take 5 hours. So I'll try to do my best in 5 minutes. Gene editing eventually is a tool that is designed to allow you to change the DNA within living cells. So if I have a cell of a banana or a mouse or a human, gene editing allows me or gives us the capability or very precisely change the DNA within that cell without killing it. So if I want to remove something or add something or make a few changes to a few base pairs very precisely, gene editing allows us to do that today incredibly fast and incredibly efficiently compared to many of the other solutions that we've had in the past. So people have been changing DNA for decades now, but never it was so available that I would say probably every PhD student in every genetics laboratory in the world today does it frequently. So that was the big game change. Now, if we think about it in the agricultural context and why this is such an amazing opportunity and there's a lot of impact, I would say that in agriculture, humanity keeps trying to develop natural food sources that are better or more adapted to our needs. So it can be bigger, healthier, more nutritious, better tasting. And there are probably three main ways of doing it today. There is breeding. There is what people kind of refer to as GMO. And there is gene editing. Now, breeding, for example, we've been doing as humanity probably, I would say, more than 10,000 years now, knowingly or unknowingly. And it's the practice of taking different varieties of the same species and crossing them, sexually breeding them in order to derive a desired new variety. So think about taking a yellow tomato and breeding it with a red tomato to try to get something kind of in between, in the middle that you want more. Now, it's working very well. People are doing it, and we know how to do it today better than we've done in the past. But it does have quite a few limitations. First of all, because it can take a lot of time. So even with tomatoes, which is a relatively fast growing crop, it can take multiple years. If you think about something like coffee, for example, if you want to breed a new variety of coffee, it can take you 30 years because coffee grows slower. Also, it becomes a lot harder when you think about crops that do not breed sexually. So, for example, bananas are an asexual crop. So it doesn't matter how much I want. It's very, very impossible to take the banana that we eat and try to breed it because it doesn't have any seeds and it's asexual. Another complication another challenge with breeding is that you can only work with what you have. So, for example, I can make a tomato that is a paler shade of red, but if I want to take a tomato and make it produce, vitamin A, it's very hard if there is no tomato in nature that knows how to produce vitamin A. So this is breeding with, the pros and the cons. Now, in the 1950s, 1960s, people started incorporating genetic engineering into these processes. And one of the earlier technologies that people have done is something called transgenesis. What we kind of think today more colloquially is GMO. It's basically the practice of taking a gene from one organism and transferring it to another organism. So for example, going back to the vitamin A tomato, for example, and it's illustrative, If I can identify maybe a bacteria that I know that has a gene that produces vitamin A, and I can take that gene from the bacteria and insert it into the tomato. With breeding, I could never do it because tomatoes and bacteria don't are not sexually compatible. But with this type of science, it could have been done, or maybe it's even done. But there are many challenges with this type of technology. I would say the level of complexity is quite high. It still is not. It requires a lot of time and effort and expertise. And maybe to some degree, even more challenging is that currently today in many countries in the world, this type of products are not allowed in the market. For example, in Europe, does not allow. It's incredibly hard to bring to the market a product that has genes that are derived from a foreign organism. And even in countries where it is allowed, for example, in the US, the regulatory process of bringing such a product to the market can take 10, 15 years and cost, let's call it $150 million. So if you look at the industry today, it's, you know, there are a lot of products like that. So about 12% of global agriculture is GMO. But you see that the large majority of products are very much centralized around a very small number of crops, like corn, soy, and cotton, these massive Western-type crops that can provide any NPV or an investment of $150 million over 15 years. Now, here comes gene editing, and this is the game changer. So gene editing, or you know, the most well-known gene editing technology, CRISPR, was first published or developed in 2012 by two ladies, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier. Both of them received the Nobel Prize for that discovery only a few weeks ago. And they developed this tool that allowed you for the first time to start changing DNA much faster, much simpler than ever before. And the second development in that is that in around 2014, 2015, it was also first indicated by some regulators, primarily in the US, that said that if you change the DNA of plants or other organisms like animals without incorporating foreign DNA, then you can be regulated as a non-GMO. So allowing you, providing you a path to the market that it's instead of 15 years and $150 million, maybe 5 years and $10 million. So it's a big, big game changer. And maybe the insight for us was that it made sense when it was costing $150 million to focus on corn. But if it costs $5 or $10 million, then it opens up a lot of other things, like bananas, like coffee. Like you can think there's a lot of different things that can be done. So this is maybe the big difference of gene editing compared to some of the other technologies that are designed to develop new and better varieties of plants out there.
Great. That's a really helpful overview. And I guess you've really solved the reasoning of genetic editing over GMO. And it's great that it's such a topical conversation, given that the Nobel Prize award was just a few weeks ago. You've mentioned bananas and coffee, and I understand that that's at least originally was the two crops that Tropic Biosciences set out to focus on. Why these two? And could you maybe talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think there's probably three main reasons that we chose coffee and bananas that are actually quite similar between these two crops that otherwise are incredibly different. And it has to do with the importance of the crop, the compatibility with the technology, and the business model. So coffee and bananas, even though we might take them for granted sometimes, these are some of the most important crops on the planet. A banana is the fourth most important food crop globally. It's the most produced and consumed fruit on the planet. And as a relatively new father, I can say that I realized that probably the first fruit that all of us have ever tasted is a banana. Coffee, similarly, is the most consumed beverage globally after water. Trade simply in the green beans of coffee is about $20 billion a year. And if you look at the broader coffee industry, at people consuming between 1.5 to 2 billion cups of coffee every day, we're talking about something that's probably quarter to half $1 trillion annually. So these are two massive, massive crops that provide a livelihood for millions of people around the world. And more surprisingly to me today is that still Tropic Biosciences is one of the only companies actually working on these crops, where you can find probably hundreds of companies working on corn and soy and cotton. The second reason was a compatibility with the technology. And as I said earlier, maybe the main alternative to gene editing is breeding. Now, I would say if you can breed, breed, don't do gene editing. But in coffee, you can do breeding. The problem is that it takes you 30 years. So if you can speed things up and get to market within 3, 4, 5 years, there is a lot of economic benefit for it and a lot of justification for using gene editing. And similarly, in banana, as I mentioned, is an asexual crop. So perhaps the only way that you actually have to develop a product that solves industry challenges is through gene editing. Lastly, I would say that from a business model perspective, coffee and bananas are markets where a small company like Tropic Biosciences can come without necessarily facing major competitors and build ourselves as a dominant force in that market. And maybe another way to say it will be this. If I wanted to work on corn, there are several very large, very good, very strong companies in that sector. For example, Bayer, BASF, Corteva, Syngenta, that have been working on corn for anywhere between 20 to 120 years, developing their intellectual property, their unique lines, their expertise. If I wanted to go into their backyard, it would have been incredibly hard for me. When I move into coffee and banana, we have the ability to become a dominant player. We can. There's no one there that has been doing it for 120 years and kind of spent a lot of effort in blocking everyone from entering. So it provides us with this blue sky opportunity of becoming a major seed company globally. So I would say I think coffee and banana was, these are very challenging crops. Being the first or kind of putting so much effort in a crop that hasn't been fully established in the past is hard, but there's a lot of benefit to it as well.
Amazing. Thank you very much. And congrats on becoming a father then.
Thank you very much.
The way you've described it, it sounds like a very big and compelling niche for Tropic Biosciences to pursue. I guess one of the things that I, and I'm sure the listeners will be interested to understand, is how big is the market opportunity sort of outside of bananas and coffee? And are there any limitations to the technology in terms of its applications and what sort of characteristics and susceptibilities it can focus on in terms of the genes? Because I think, as I understand it now, it's mainly focused on disease and limiting that.
Yeah. I would say if we're talking about the market opportunity, I would say that the opportunities are very large. Because when you enter a crop segment, and it doesn't matter if it's coffee, banana, corn, or quinoa, as a genetic developer, if you have a variety that you've developed and patented, which is clearly overperforming or something that the farmers really, really want, it gives you a lot of power being at the start of the value chain. And from there, you can take it into many different ways. You can, it gives you the opportunity to collaborate with the farmers. It gives you the opportunity to maybe grow further downstream into distribution and production. So I think that being at the very, very start point of the value chain gives you a lot of flexibility that you might not have if you are the kind of the middle part of it. As for the applicability of the technology, I would say that there's, it's a relatively new technology. Every month, there's new developments. So I think that we are only now starting to understand the possibilities. I will say that very easily we can say that some things are definitely easier today than others. I'll give you an example. One of the very basic things that people have been doing with gene editing is something called gene knockouts. I mentioned earlier that in order to be designed as non-GMO, one of the key criteria is to not incorporate any foreign DNA. One way to accomplish it is by engineering plants only by removing or reducing the activity of genes. So for example, if I have in coffee a gene that I know that is critical in the production of caffeine, I can simply knock that gene out or kind of cut it and let it repair in a faulty way so that it no longer conducts its function in the production of caffeine. And now I can produce coffee that has less caffeine. This is called gene knockouts. And we do it. We're actually developing coffee that has less caffeine. And in bananas, for example, you can knock out genes that control the production and synthesis of ethylene, which is a component that turns bananas from green to yellow. So by knocking those genes out, you can extend the shelf life, the green shelf life of the banana, and allow to be, you know, transported further and reduce waste. Other interesting examples, you can knock out gluten from wheat or the component that makes peanuts allergenic. All of these are fantastic applications, but there's also, I would say, a very small opportunity landscape. I don't think that there are millions of traits like this. There's probably tens that are commercially viable. Now, I will say that probably over the last 2, 3, 4 years, there's been more and more developments and improvements of the technology to allow achieving more things than simply to knock out, so removing things from the plant. One area that we really focus on in tropic biosciences, which I think is very unique to us, is actually taking it to the realm of crop protection or how to fight off diseases. I will say that it's very hard to fight a fungi or a virus or a pest simply by removing a gene. And this is where we had to be a lot more creative and create a technology that allowed us to use gene editing in order to fight off diseases. Now, interestingly for us, we developed it for bananas, but we are now using it also in rice internally, and we have quite a few clients that are using it in canola, in soybean, in pigs and cows and shrimp and many other things. So this was kind of one of the benefits of being a very early and fast mover in the industry. So I will say that kind of removing things is probably the easiest thing. More complex things like fighting off a biotic stress like pests or abiotic stress like heat, drought, salinity, these are probably a higher level of complexity.
Great, that's fascinating. And I guess putting my sustainability hat on and thinking about things such as bananas with their longer shelf life and improved yields as a result of sort of disease resistance is great in terms of in a world where we're growing populations and finding it harder and harder to actually produce the amount we require to feed a growing population given climate change.
I would say with gene editing in agriculture, it's interesting. You know, we've been asked a lot: is gene editing, can it contribute fight off climate change or reduce the impacts of global warming or promote more sustainable practices? And I will actually say that it will be very, very hard to find a gene editing product that makes production better that doesn't have a positive impact on the environment. Or if you want to even take it further, not just on the environment, but also on the growing communities, because if they can make more money, then that's fantastic. I'll give a few examples. So for example, if you fight off diseases in agriculture using gene editing, so you've basically taken a practice that is genetic, that doesn't require any chemicals or even applications. You've changed the plant to become more resistant, and that allows you to use less chemicals, that allows you to reduce waste. So if in the past you needed, I don't know, 100 hectares to feed the community, now you can maybe produce the same amount of food over 80 hectares because you're losing less for diseases. If you also think about traits like improved transportation, shelf life, etc., you can, again, reduce waste. You know, bananas, just as an example, bananas, there's 20 million tons of bananas being shipped around the world every year. And bananas are highly perishable. If you can reduce waste by 5-10%, the impact on the planet will be noticeable. Again, if you can make a plant more desirable for people on the shelf, you know, again, you reduce wastage in the supermarkets or at people's homes, and that has a positive effect.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I can see why Tropic Biosciences has attracted some of the leading investors in the space. It was like such a compelling opportunity. Switching gears slightly, I was interested to understand, so who your customers actually are, who are buying, is it the technology or is it the seeds that you are applying the technology to? And how do the costs compare to a non-gene edited crop type?
Sure. So I think what we employ today is a bit of a hybrid business model, in which our focus and long-term profit centers are selling seeds to farmers. But we are using the opportunity in the shorter term. There's a lot of people who are interested in our technology, so we are happy to license it to them or give them service around it to generate short-term revenues. But for us, from day one, we set up to develop a seed company. I think that many of us have a lot of experience in the industry. Some of my colleagues built and sold agricultural technology companies. And what we've noticed is that there's a lot of companies in ourselves because it's such so science heavy that there's a lot of, I would say, smaller companies that are designed to develop technologies and either provide them as a service to some of the bigger companies in the world, some of the big seed companies like Monsanto, which is now part of Bayer, or Syngenta, or Corteva, with the aim of maybe even at some point being acquired by them. But this is not what we wanted to do. We felt that, you know, we don't want to just develop a technology with the hope that someone will acquire us in a few years. I feel that it's, you know, it's not, it doesn't fit our ambitions. For us, we said from day one that we want to develop these products and sell them directly to the farmers or through distributors to the farmers. We felt that instead of us aiming for maybe 10 seed companies in the world that can become clients for technology, let's aim for the billions of farmers that can acquire our products. It made a lot more economic sense to us. I would say pretty much all aspects of our work derived from that decision. I can give a few examples. If we wanted to sell technologies, we wouldn't necessarily work on coffee or banana. We would work on something more established like corn. But because we want to be a seed company, it made sense to us to work on coffee and banana because we can sell to the growers and we don't have to go through big seed companies that control the corn sector. Even in the formation of our team, so even though still out of the 80 plus employees that we have, I would say probably 60 of them are technology oriented, we do have a lot of in-house capabilities that are fitting for a seed company. So finance, commercial, regulation, intellectual property, etc., that are designed to give us these required capabilities. And I would even say, you know, being based in Norwich is a long-term play for us. If it was pure technology, you know, being based in Boston would have been just as good. But thinking about the long-term, how we can grow and become a company, not just of 80 people, but of 800 people, a place like Norwich could accommodate that. So I hope that was a good answer.
No, that's really, really interesting. And almost the more I ask, the more questions that come, it's just fascinating. Conscious of time and wanting to start wrapping up, I guess a last question on the technology. And do you get any pushbacks from potential customers? And do you see whether there are any risks? Because I guess that people have historically seen GMO as controversial. You've very well and eloquently explained how it's different, but is there still a slight translation barrier or just a mind block to this sort of technology?
Sure. So I'll try to break it into two. We can talk about kind of the demand that we are sensing from the farmers on the field, as well as we can talk about regulation, because that's also important. And even there, we can split it, because we eventually, as product developers in this market, we can say that we have multiple clients, but it's not just the farmers. It's also we always have to take into consideration the consumer public. So we can have different messages coming from the farmer or from the, you know, the people who would eventually go to Tesco to buy our bananas. I would say from the farmer side, it's a lot easier, in the sense that there's a very direct correlation with their operations. I think the better the solutions that you're providing, or the better you address critical needs in the field, the more they want you. So for example, if I go to a banana farmer and I tell him, I have a banana with longer shelf life, he likes it. You know, he says, okay, now I can grow my bananas for a longer time and increase my yield by 10%. Fantastic, I'm interested. But if you talk to him then about another product that we are developing, which is a banana that is resistant to a disease called black sigatoka, which the banana farmers today, in order to combat that fungi, they spray their fields anywhere between 30 to 90 times a year. So it ends up becoming about 30%+ of the production costs is just paying for the fungicide sprays of the field. Then you tell them, you know, perhaps we can solve it, and somebody is incredibly excited, because it's, if you reduce production costs by 30% or even half of it, 15%, the impact on the profit margins is far greater. So I think the farmers are easier in the sense that the better solution you give them, the more they want it. Now, the other aspect of it is regulation and public perception. From a regulatory perspective, this is a new technology. Of course, in every discussion that we have with people, they ask, is it GMO? Is it non-GMO? And the answer is not binary. It's not yes or no. The reality today is that in some countries in the world, for example, in the European Union, gene editing, even if you don't incorporate foreign DNA, it is considered a GMO. However, in more and more countries, and every year there's a growing number of those, more and more countries are treating it as non-GMO. So I mentioned the US, but since over the last 5 years, countries like Brazil and Canada and Australia and Israel and Chile, recently China, India is on the right way, Japan. So more and more massive markets are basically saying, you know, it's a good technology, it's safe, we don't need to undergo a 15-year regulatory process in order to approve some of these very good products to the market. So I would say that the regulatory landscape is really moving favorably in the direction towards gene editing. And lastly, maybe the most challenging is consumers. Because again, it's not, these are billions of people, and I don't think it's realistic to be able to convince everyone, but Atropic Biosciences, the path that we have taken in order to have a good dialogue with the public and try to have the public like us, trust our work, and being eventually happy to acquire our products, it's actually pretty simple. First of all, we do need to engage with the public. As I said earlier, we cannot just speak with the farmers before, because the farmers want to take what saves them cost or allow them to get better revenues. With the public, there's more. It's more challenging to discuss. So it's first of all understand that we need to engage with the public, and you know, whether it's speaking on podcasts or with newspapers or TV shows, etc. Secondly, and even more importantly, I would say, is really on focus. Atropic Biosciences, we only develop products that not only are good, but also relatively easy to explain. So I would say that it's relatively easy for us to sit with people and say, you know, why low caffeine coffee is fantastic, because it's more sustainable, it's you know, retains more of the health qualities of the original coffee, etc., etc. And people understand. They say, okay, I like it. It's easy for us to explain why, you know, if we didn't do our work, then there might not be any more bananas 10 years from today. So people say, yeah, fantastic, save the banana. There are other things that are a lot harder for us to explain, for example, like herbicide tolerance, which is a fantastic trait, I think, but the public doesn't react to it very well. So the second part is really choosing the right products that the public likes. And thirdly, it has to do with transparency. We don't do, you know, too many PRs and try to sell ourselves. What we do try to do is be very transparent about our work, and we invite reporters and others to visit our facilities and to ask questions and to take pictures. We don't try to say that our gene editing work is anything but exactly what it is. So we don't try to give it, you know, kind of cool names that, you know, doesn't say genes or DNA or editing, and kind of try to masquerade it a little bit. It doesn't work within 2020, not, you know, 100 years ago. And so far, what we've experienced relating to this dialogue and transparency and focusing on good product, I would say that we are getting a lot of good feedback. And good for us, because this good feedback, I think there's a lot of companies in the world that want us to succeed. And companies, some very, very big names that are more than happy to support us and give us advice. Or food companies that want to work with us because they trust us as good players in the market. So, you know, doing good works very well for us.
Yeah, I think talking about trust and transparency, it's a key attribute in especially the 21st century, but for any business. So thank you very much for taking the time to explain that. I just wanted to finish off with a final question for the listeners who hopefully find this interesting. As a successful, clearly successful entrepreneur and venture capital investor, what single piece of career advice would you give listeners and aspiring listeners who will take a lot of inspiration from the conversation today?
I have many advice, and probably none of them is very good. But I will say a few things. I will say that first of all, and a lot of time I have people, and by the way, I've gone through the same process myself when I was doing my master's degree in business and administration. I also found myself in a crossroad, and I wasn't sure really what I wanted to do. And I got some person gave me a fantastic advice, and he said, "Sit down, you know, take two pages. On one, write all the things that you love to do. And don't limit yourself to business stuff. You know, you like traveling, you like eating, you know, write all the things that you love to do. And on the second page, write all the things that you enjoy doing." I found that every time that I sit down and write these two pages, it really helps me set myself in the right direction. Because I think that when you operate in that intersection of things that you're good at and things that you enjoy doing, and hopefully that you can, you know, it's there's also good compensation for it, then it's a very good track for success. The second advice I will say, again, I do not consider myself as a successful venture capitalist or as a successful entrepreneur. Time will tell, hopefully. And I definitely don't compare myself to some of the best entrepreneurs in the world, like, I don't know, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. I will say, look at some of these people. I would say take Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Steve Jobs. I don't know. You think about some really, really fantastic entrepreneurs. There's probably very little similarities between them in many ways. Different personalities, different everything. However, I do think that there's a few personality traits that are good indicators for success. And I would say that one of them is dedication. Being a successful entrepreneur, it's close to an obsession. It's not a part-time job. It's not something that you do 9 to 5. It doesn't. Hopefully, if you're doing it well, it doesn't leave you. You know, you think about it the last thing that you think about when you go to bed, and the first thing that you think about when you wake up, and over the weekends, you really have to go with tough skin, and you have to be very tenacious about it, because when it's something that's so important for you, every minor setback, every step forward, everything becomes very impactful. And you really need to be able to kind of stand up and move forward. And it happens all the time. So you have to really keep working at it.
Great. Thank you. That's some incredible and very humble advice there, which I'm sure will provide inspiration for all of our listeners. So I think that's taken us to the end of the podcast today. So I just want to take the opportunity to thank you once again for your time and your incredible insights.
Fantastic. So thank you very, very much. And if any of the listeners, we are constantly hiring for good business people, and we're happy to engage.